This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, The Color of Law, Ernie Goodman, Detroit, and the Struggle for Labor and Civil Rights is the title of the recent book, recreating the compelling story of Ernie Goodman, one of the nation's preeminent defense attorneys for workers and the militant poor.
From the sit-down strikes in Detroit to the civil rights movement in the South to the Attica prison rebellion in the North.
We'll talk about the mortgage crisis. The same banks we bailed out are still standing to make hundreds of billions on foreclosures of homes.
Our taxpayer money went to support what they call ninja loans. These loans were made on the basis of no income, no jobs, and no assets. And now the banks are foreclosing on the people that got suckered into taking out those loans in the first place.
Stay with us.
Recently, the, quote, child soldier Omar Khadr pled guilty to various crimes down in Guantanamo. What's your take on that?
Well, an interesting take on this for beginners is at a press conference afterwards, his lawyer said that Omar Khadr was innocent. Essentially, you shouldn't really accept this plea for guilt. And to the extent anyone listening to this show or anyone reading it, believing that Omar Khadr was guilty of this, it's just not the case. This is what I would call a show plea, and it's actually an illegal plea. He was 15 years old at the time he was picked up. That makes him a child soldier under the Child Convention and everything else. The U.S. insisted on trying a child soldier. It's illegal to have charged him, illegal to have put him into the trial, and illegal to accept his plea. But here's what he's facing. Let's look at what he's facing. Obama, continuing the Bush tradition, the Bush law, had set up and continued to run the military commission. So he's being tried by a rump court. He was tortured, and apparently he said something under torture that if it was a regular court, could not be used. But of course, because he's in a military commission, it can be used. The U.S. then insists that even if he isn't tried, they can hold him indefinitely and forever. So here's this kid, 15 at the time he was picked up, now 24, picked up for a supposedly committing a conspiracy to commit murder in Afghanistan, but he's picked up at 15 for that. And let's also remember his father was an admitted member of Al-Qaeda who took this kid to Afghanistan when he was 9 years old, and the U.S. picked him up when he was 15. So think about whether this is a kid who should be tried as a 15-year-old. So he's put before a military commission. Evidence of torture is going to be used. The U.S. says we can hold you forever anyway. And they basically said, you either plea to whatever we tell you to plea to, and if you don't, we're going to put you on trial. And they made a secret deal with him of what would happen to him if he pled to whatever the U.S. said. So the U.S. put out a whole bunch of charges about murder and mayhem or whatever else that he'd never even been charged with originally. And he said, okay, I'll plead to these. And of course, the side deal here is that we don't know yet exactly what it is, but it's probably a year or so or less in Guantanamo and maybe 6 or 7 years in Canada. But of course, because he's a Canadian citizen, but of course, he's probably never going to serve a day in Canada. So this is really what I call a show plea. The U.S. wants to save face because here they were going to the first military commission trial in 8 years with a 15-year-old, or at least a kid who allegedly committed an offense when he was 15 years old. That Obama continued this charade should tell us everything about Obama because this was a gimme. All Obama had to say was, I'm not trying a 15-year-old in front of a military commission. He should be rehabilitated and that's it. He couldn't do that. Instead, disgusting a cesspool is all I can say, making this poor kid plead to a list of charges. Now they're going to have a sentencing hearing. That's going to be interesting because the sentencing hearing before all the military people, they're going to schlep in every single widow of someone who died in this incident, and they're going to all do whatever they do, and they're going to do all that. Then the panel's probably going to give him a very long sentence, maybe even a life sentence. But, of course, he can't get a longer sentence than he agreed to in the plea. So they're going to give him a life sentence to show, you know, America, well, here's what we would do. But, in fact, the kid is going to get the year and then 6 or 7 in Canada. I mean, I don't even have words for it, Michael. It's just the most disgusting scenario. I mean, it's a fake. The whole thing is just BS.
A show plea. That's the word.
Right.
The Color of Law, Ernie Goodman, Detroit, and the Struggle for Labor and Civil Rights is the title of the recent book, recreating the compelling story of Ernie Goodman, one of the nation's preeminent defense attorneys for workers and the militant poor. Author Steve Babson, Dave Riddle, and David Elsilla tell the story from the beginning, starting with Goodman's early years as a corporate lawyer to his conversion to labor law during the Great Depression. From Detroit to Mississippi, Goodman saw police and other officials giving the, quote, color of law to actions that stifled freedom of speech and nullified the rights of workers and minorities. This book demonstrates that the abuse of power is nonpartisan and that individuals who oppose injustice can change the course of events. To talk more about the book, we're joined by Ernie Goodman's son, Bill. Bill Goodman, the former legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, has been an extraordinary public interest lawyer for over three decades and has served as counsel on issues including post-Katrina social justice, public housing, voting rights, police misconduct, living wage, educational reform, human rights work in Haiti, and civil disobedience. We're also joined by one of the authors, Steve Babson. He's a labor educator and union activist living in Detroit for the last 32 years with his wife, Nancy Brigham. Bill Goodman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be with you all.
We're thrilled to be talking about The Color of Law, the book that documents your father and some of the great people's movements of the last few decades. What's your reaction to the book?
I think the book is really surprisingly delightful because it goes beyond my dad as just an individual person who led a wonderful life and talks about the experience of going through the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, 50s, and 60s and into the 70s and what it meant to be an engaged and involved person in the politics of that period.
Yeah, I think so as well, Bill. I read it and I just thought it really brought alive your dad and the period he was in. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about what you consider some of the most significant parts of your dad's, at least, legal political life?
Well, without a doubt, and I think the book makes this point so vividly, his awakening as a political person came about during the formation of the current, what has been the labor movement in the United States for the last century. And the sit-down strikes in Flint and the beginnings of the labor movement just before that, and then the organizing the contract with the Ford Motor Company, the emergence and early days of the UAW. I think that that was really incredibly important period for him and for the country, and his role was instrumental. He was one of the key people who provided legal representation and counseling and tactics and strategy to the UAW, which was the most progressive labor union in the United States at that time.
You know, we always hear about the Flint sit-downs, but, you know, probably a lot of our listeners may not be aware of what they were and how recently, really, they occurred and how, in some way, how new the labor movement is or how old it's gotten. But tell us a little about that Flint situation.
Well, there were sit-down strikes. The UAW tried to stage a few experimental sit-downs before the Flint sit-downs. It discussed in the book, the sit-downs in Flint themselves were in 1937. The workers literally took over the factories from General Motors, the most powerful corporation in the United States at the time. And the question was whether the governor was going to send in the troops and basically kick the workers out and probably hurt or perhaps kill some of them. And Frank Murphy, who happened to be a progressive figure in Michigan politics in many ways, was the governor and refused to send in the troops. This was a key moment. And the UAW had been, and the labor movement had been instrumental in the election of Frank Murphy to the governorship. So that sort of was it. But taking power and grabbing these factories away from these huge corporations was enormously important and symbolic.
At some point, your father and the firm he was with stopped representing, really, the UAW. What happened?
Well, he worked for a man named Maurice Sugar, who was a very important figure in American politics and the law at that time. Both of them were founding members of the National Lawyers Guild, as all of you know. Sugar was fired as the general counsel for the UAW because of the beginnings of the Cold War. Walter Reuther, who was an interesting figure and dynamic figure in American labor history, decided that he was going to ride the wave of the Cold War and anti-communism and basically get rid of the radicals and communists within the Union. So they fired Ruther, and along with Ruther, they fired my dad and his firm. They fired Sugar, and along with firing Sugar, they fired my dad and his firm. They then were out basically no longer could represent most labor unions, although they continued to represent a few progressive ones and progressive UAW locals. So they then were stuck with representing all of those people who were being attacked under them in the McCarthy period in front of the House and American Activities Committee, in the Smith Act trials, in which basically communism was put on trial as an idea and as a system of thought. The First Amendment was not a protection. These were the early days of their representation, and this firm, the first non-segregated interracial law firm in the United States, started out with its black partner, George Crockett, who later became a congressman, in prison for contempt in the Foley Square Smith Act trial.
It's one of my favorite stories. I mean, I know you knew George Crockett really well.
Well.
And I knew him not as well as you, but pretty well. And, you know, he was an amazing figure, and, of course, he was your dad's partner. And as you said, it was the first, we think, interracial law firm in the United States. And it's quite extraordinary. And I know you were a member of that firm as well.
I was. And Crockett was one of the most courageous people I've ever known in my life in many ways. He would not bend, and he would basically, he was continually attacked for asserting and protecting the Constitution of the United States. And I just have huge admiration for the man.
Bill, the book also talks about your father's involvement with the Attica defense. Can you talk about that a bit?
I can talk about Attica. He got involved in the Attica case because of me. At that time, I decided to start organizing lawyers from Detroit to start going to Buffalo and representing defendants who were charged in the Attica uprising. As you all know, the Attica prison, there was an uprising between September 9th and September 13th of 1971, at which time Nelson Rockefeller sent in state troopers and National Guard, and in which more than three dozen people were killed, all by gunshots, and the prisoners had no guns, and no hostages were killed except by gunshots, which means they were shot by the state troopers. As a result of that, there was a grand jury, and there were criminal prosecutions against leaders of the prisoners who were leaders of the uprising. And my dad had got one of those cases. He decided he wanted to take one. Well, he took the case for Shango Bahati Kakawana, also known as Bernard Strobel, who was from Detroit and really wanted my dad to represent him. And that was one of the first major trials and the first one which we won, in which we basically showed to a jury what this prosecution had done was to hide information from the jury, hide information from the defense, and try to cover up the fact that they had killed and murdered people at Attica and put the blame on people who were not to blame, the ways in which they had used snitches and informants and threatened people and coerced people. This was all put on trial, and this was the one that we won in this case. And I was part of that. I was honored to be part of that trial team along with my dad, and along with Shango, who was pro se on one of the counts, and along with the wonderful, unforgettable Haywood Burns.
Bill, let's talk about your father in the Civil Rights Federation and your father's involvement very early in the civil rights movement. And your father is a movement lawyer. He wasn't just a lawyer, but he was out there as the head of the Civil Rights Federation in Detroit back in the 30s. And I wanted to ask you about that and then bring it forward to your father's work as president of the National Lawyers Guild and working in Mississippi during the Civil Rights Movement 20 years later.
Well, the Civil Rights Federation had been formed basically because in that period, which was when it was formed, we were still in the throes of reaction to the Reconstruction period following the Civil War and then the reaction to it and the growth of the Klan. And the tax assaults on African Americans at that time massively politically throughout the country in one way or another, and certainly in many personal ways, including murders, violence, lynchings of all sorts. And my dad became very involved in this and was one of the active people in the Civil Rights Congress at that time, the Civil Rights Federation, which was its earlier title. This movement brought a number of very progressive African-American people into progressive politics. People like Coleman Young, for example, who was highlighted in this book and was very involved during that period. and Crockett was another, and there were many others as well. This work was formative for him in understanding the importance of race and the vice of racism and segregation, all of those badges and vestiges of slavery. So he became very conscious, very aware of that. It was formative in his ideas of how to build a law firm and how to represent people, and how he became an important representative of many of the most oppressed people in the city of Detroit at that time, which was the African-American community largely. Then, of course, we know that after the pale of McCarthyism lifted in the late 50s, the Civil Rights Movement took hold, and you had the Freedom Rides in 1961, the development of Freedom Summer, and my dad and Crockett and our law firm primarily took the lead within the National Lawyers Guild of saying this has to be the priority of the Guild to represent the Civil Rights Movement, to be the lawyers for this movement, which is the most vital movement in the country and maybe in the century that anyone could think of. They did that, and the Guild started a law office in Jackson, Mississippi in the summer of 64. Crockett was the head of it, and then another African-American lawyer from our firm, Judge Claudia Morecambe, ran the office for approximately a year in 1965, and it did important and really major formative things and was at the center of the Civil Rights Movement during that period.
I have a question about that. I think it refers to it in the book. Your dad was one of the key people along with Crockett in the Southern Civil Rights Movement and representing people, and saw that early on. And at some point, there was an issue about, you know, the sort of left credentials of the Guild and other groups. I don't remember, I think the NAACP or LDF wanting to sort of push the Guild out of the South. I recall something about this in the book.
Yes, well, there was some of that, and there was an attempt. And it was also part of COINTELPRO. The FBI was in behind a good deal of this, to say to the rest of the civil rights movement, to Martin Luther King, certainly, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and other groups in the NAACP, certainly as well, that you're now getting in bed with communists, and you better be careful and draw back and not involve yourself with the Guild. And this became, in many ways, a negative factor, but in some ways it forced the rest of the American, the legal profession to form a number of other grassroots law offices, so such as the Lawyers for Civil Rights that went down into Mississippi and Alabama as well. And so there was a proliferation of civil rights law firms, and they all ended up working closely together, but there certainly was an attempt to split the civil rights movement around the left credentials of the Guild.
We're talking with Bill Goodman, whose father, Ernie Goodman, is the subject of the recently published book, The Color of Law, a magnificent book, and we're real glad to have Bill on the air with us.
Bill, as one of the most respected constitutional lawyers in this country, was there ever a doubt that you would follow in your father's footsteps?
Was there ever doubt? Well, did I ever doubt it, or did he ever doubt it? It flowed pretty naturally from my experience. I'll tell you, went to law school almost as a second choice because my grades weren't quite good enough to get me into graduate school and start in a career of teaching or something like that. So I decided to go to law school, which I'm very happy about that decision. But once I made that decision in law school, I think I was the first student member of the National Lawyers Guild in many years. I was sworn in as a member to help organize the Chicago chapter of the Guild. I went to law school in Chicago. And from that, and that only happened because of my connection with my father, of course. And then the following, that summer, after my first year in law school, I went down south and worked for a civil rights law firm, Jordan, Dawley, and Holt, and specifically for Len Holt, who was one of the heroes, and that was of the civil rights movement. That was a very formative experience for me. After that, there was no way that I was going to turn back on what I saw as the only way to conscientiously follow the law and enforce the Constitution.
Talk about your dad starting off as a corporate lawyer, came from a poor immigrant family in rural Michigan, moved to Detroit and is hoping to make a living. Then the Depression hits and he gets politicized. What lessons do we have from the arc of your father's career?
I don't know what lessons. People can draw their own lessons in their own lives from other people's. But what happened with him was that he was born in rural Michigan. They moved to Detroit into the Jewish ghetto here in Detroit, and when he was 5 years old, started school, and then tried to be successful as a first-generation family of Jewish immigrants. And in so doing, I wouldn't call him a corporate lawyer, but he tried to represent small business accounts whenever he could and collect debts. So he became kind of a collection lawyer and then saw this whole society suddenly, with the crash of the stock market in 1929, crumble around him, and saw people in huge, enormous need. Not so different than what we see walking around the streets of Detroit today, by the way. And asked himself, what, there must be a better way to do this, and then saw the possibilities through the beginnings of the labor movement at that time and his beginnings of understanding at least the principles of socialism, which called on society to exert through its government some social conscience, that he saw another approach. And I think that's, as you say, the arc of what he perceived at that point.
The Color of Law, just an excellent book. We encourage everybody to go out and get The Color of Law.
The book is wonderful. I do hope people can read it. And beyond that, I'm very grateful and very fortunate to have been born at the time I was into the family I was and had the opportunities to be a progressive person in my work and in other ways as well. So
I read the book and I couldn't put it down. It's just an incredible social, political, and personal history of the 20th century. I mean, just remarkable.
Ditto, Michael. I was up at 4:30 in the morning last night reading it. It's a great history.
Bill, thanks so much.
Thanks, Bill.
Okay, thanks, everybody.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Steve, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And we're interviewing Steve Babson, one of the authors of The Color of Law, the story of Ernie Goodman, a prominent Detroit lawyer, progressive. And we're interested in, first, how did you come to write this book?
Well, Ernie, of course, was a compelling focus for our interest just because of his prominent role on the left and as a progressive in the Detroit area. And when he died in 1997, his wife, Frieda, wanted to find some way of basically chronicling his life and his experience, made the effort to contact first Dave Elsola, who enlisted Dave Riddle to actually start writing the book. And Dave Elsola and I were helping Dave Riddle at the start as he made some of the initial decisions about what the book would look like. And Dave then became actually ill with Parkinson's disease and some serious health issues that had him in and out of the hospital. And I'm his neighbor, so was Dave Elsola. We were taking care of him, and we saw what a wonderful start he had made to the book, and so we picked it up, and I became the lead writer in about 2005, 2006. Both Dave Elsola and Dave Riddle continued contributing sections to it, and I took on the responsibility of the overall book.
Steve, what struck me as, I think, the great value of this book is that it positions Ernie Goodman and his wonderful legal and political work in the social history of Detroit and really America as it unfolded from the 20s up into the 90s,
right.
So that somebody that reads this book profits both ways. It's just a tremendous accomplishment that I think you three authors did. And I wanted to ask you, because when you recreate, and to me it was the most exciting part of the book, was Ernie Goodman as a young man becoming a radical lawyer, becoming a socialist, becoming an activist in Detroit, and getting involved in the movement, which reached its high point in Detroit really in 37. Talk to us about that, will you?
Sure. I mean, he was not unlike millions of other people in the United States who confronted the collapse and failure, really, of capitalism. And in Detroit, an even more severe crisis than elsewhere. The unemployment rate in Detroit had to be estimated because no one wanted to collect the actual statistics, but it was well over 50%. And there were people being brought to the local morgue and the local hospitals every morning that they were collecting the cadavers off the streets, literally four or five every morning who were dying of starvation. And it was in that context that Ernie Goodman, who had been up until that moment a fledgling lawyer trying to make his way in the world of business law, not with a whole lot of success given, among other things, the prejudice against Jewish lawyers at the time, And he finally has a conversion crisis. He's a repo man, actually, for repossessing the furniture and sometimes participating in evictions, which brought him face-to-face with the unemployed councils and a lot of the early organizing in response to the crisis of the Depression. And he finally has a conversion crisis where he finds his way to the other side, in effect, of the barricades, and he joins the people who are contesting the outcomes of the Great Depression, fighting to organize on the workplace, but also to defend themselves in the community, to block evictions. And he makes an abrupt turn and joins that movement, and very shortly is then involved in that remarkable wave of sit-down strikes by which Detroit workers asserted their rights on the job. They had the rights by law, but employers refused to abide by the National Labor Relations Act, and so the sit-down strikes were kind of a citizen's arrest, where thousands, actually 35,000 workers in Detroit, over 100 sit-down strikes, demanded basically one thing, and that was that the corporations abide by the law and give them the opportunity to voice their support for unions and mobilize on behalf of voting a majority of them to have union representation. So that's really what established Ernie's initial understanding of what a social movement might look like, that and also his support for the Spanish Republic, which gave him also an initial interest in international issues and a perspective broader beyond just the boundaries of Detroit.
Well, Steve Babson, one of the co-authors of The Color of Law, the very fine book about attorney Ernie Goodman. Talk to us about the Civil Rights Federation in Detroit, because I think one of the lessons that I got from this book is, boy, could we use an organization like that right now in New York City. Talk about who was in that organization, what they tried to do, and Ernie's role in it.
It's a fascinating little chapter in the history of the civil rights movement, because when you go back to the early beginnings of the modern civil rights movement, it's overlapping with and coming out of the labor movement. And it's the Congress of Industrial Organizations and the UAW and this upsurge of worker mobilization on the job on behalf of industrial unions and an effort to turn back the Great Depression that leads to the black and white unity in the workplace, tenuous and often problematic, but nevertheless, the CIO is the first to advocate this kind of approach, unifying people on the job and in the community. And the Civil Rights Federation was supported by these new unions, these new militant organizations that were trying to repair the damage of the Great Depression, as I said. And they basically draw in a mixture of basically clerical leaders from across the spectrum and also union activists and union leaders, folks from the community, and progressive lawyers like Ernie Goodman, who came together in an effort to try and turn back not only the employer illegal activity and violence that was attempting to suppress unions, but there were also vigilante groups that were very active at this time in the 1930s in Detroit, most visibly an organization called the Black Legion, which was a right-wing breakoff from the Ku Klux Klan. They considered the Klan too moderate, and the Black Legion actually organized a group of Knight Riders, in effect, about 300 members of that organization who constituted a death squad, and they would assassinate union organizers and progressives within the New Deal coalition. And it was the Civil Rights Federation that addressed not only questions of segregation in the neighborhoods and on the job, but also the role of these vigilante groups in trying to roll back the New Deal and the CIO.
Let me just fast forward, because this is such a dramatic story. Ernie Goodman is approaching the end of his life. There's a huge strike in Detroit with the newspaper workers, and it's the middle of winter, and Ernie Goodman goes out there. Talk about that day.
Well, it's quite a moment. It was the year before he died, actually, and he's 90 years old. He's never been arrested himself. Over the many decades, he's represented folks who were active in the civil rights movement, folks in the labor movement, of course, and the anti-war movements and the Black Power movements, Black Panthers, the Attica rebels. But he himself has never actually been on the other side of the arrest procedure. He's been defending folks. And so in 1996, during the Detroit newspaper strike, when the newspapers here that had just formed a joint operating agreement, basically a government-sanctioned monopoly of the daily press in the city, then proceeded to cut wages and slash jobs and provoked a prolonged and very bitter conflict over those initiatives. And in support of those striking unions, several organizations in the community and supportive of the labor movement began to organize weekly, basically sit-downs in front of the Detroit News Building to mark our symbolic support for the unions and to draw attention to the ongoing conflict. And Ernie joined that procedure, and 1 week he and other progressive professionals came together and peacefully sat down in front of the door and was carried away. Actually, he got up and was escorted to the police bus and taken downtown and actually booked. And by all accounts, he was very, very happy to be able to finally take that particular role and be on that side of the struggle. Defended, by the way, by the Goodman firm, actually.
Well, you reap what you sow. Steve Babson, talk to us about Frank Murphy, the mixed role that he played in the politics of Detroit and our country in Ernie's life. He was Ernie's professor. He proved to be, in some ways, a great disappointment, in a way sort of like Obama. Talk about Frank Murphy and his ascendancy.
Well, a lot of positive in that story. Frank Murphy became the governor of Michigan was elected in 1936, and he ran on a platform where he promised never to call out the National Guard to break a union. And then, of course, the Flint sit-down strike at General Motors began, and he did call out the National Guard, but it was to prevent the police from attacking the strikers who were demanding their rights under the law and opposing GM's illegal behavior. And Murphy, in that regard, was a very positive step forward, and he had a long career also previously as mayor. But he also had, there was another side to the coin, unfortunately, and that included most prominently his role as Attorney General, where he, following his tenure as governor, he was driven out of office, actually, by an early version of the House Un-American Activities, led by a guy named Martin Dies. He ends up being appointed by Roosevelt, President Roosevelt, as Attorney General, and in that role, he ended up favoring the elevation of J. Edgar Hoover to the prominence he would thereafter hold in terms of the national security state. And at that time, there was a conflict within the government over who would have responsibility for national security, and Murphy favored Hoover in that regard and did so in a way that had a very nasty twist to it, because when Murphy was then nominated for the Supreme Court, in order to burnish his anti-communist credentials, he ordered the arrest of 10 or 11 folks in Detroit for long-standing claims that they had been recruiting for, probably true, by the way, but never prosecuted before, that they had been recruiting volunteers to fight in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade to oppose fascism in Spain, and this violated laws prohibiting that kind of recruitment on U.S. soil. But no one had ever prosecuted them, and no one had prosecuted the other side for their recruitment on behalf of Franco. So there was this brutish arrest of these 10 folks, and the charges were later dropped when they had done had the effect that I guess Murphy had hoped they would have, in terms of he being able to say to Congress, "See, I've actually participated in the anti-communist crusade here," so that apparently made him suitable for the Supreme Court. I should add that he went on at the Supreme Court to write some really wonderful decisions and actually had a very positive role, I would argue, on the Supreme Court. But it's a kind of checkered career, and it was one Ernie ran into a lot. And he discovered that the abuse of power was nonpartisan, that it rarely mattered whether it was Democrat or Republican, particularly when it came to foreign policy and a devotion to augmenting the national security state against enemies real and imagined.
Well, that's why your book, The Color of Law, is such a rich, wonderful book, Steve Babson.
Steve, the National Lawyers Guild features prominently throughout the book, sort of like reading a history. And I wondered if you could speak a bit about how Ernie helped sort of revive the guild during the McCarthy era.
Well, yeah, it's a wonderful aspect to his role, because the National Lawyers Guild, which was organized back in 1937 to bring together progressive lawyers who supported the labor movement, supported the civil rights movement, and who were opposed, I should add, to the American Bar Association at that time, which was a whites-only organization, explicitly refused to enlist as members African-American lawyers, quite conservative, men only, I should add. The Lawyers Guild represented a progressive alternative, and on that basis quickly grew by the late 30s to about 5,000 members. And also very quickly there were internal conflicts within the Guild about the place for communists within the organization. Of course, there was a wide variety of political opinion in the Guild, but it included members of the Communist Party, and that was a matter that really came to a head in the late 40s and 1950s, when the Attorney General declared that the Guild was a subversive organization, began a process of persecution, I should say, that actually discouraged membership and drove members out of the Guild out of fear that they would otherwise be stigmatized in their professional life and perhaps called before the House on American Activities or whatnot. And the organization plummeted from about 5,000 members to under 500. So 90% of the membership of the Guild was driven from its ranks by this concerted and fabricated web of lies about what the organization was about. And this was, of course, typical of the McCarthy era. And what Ernie did was he took the remaining core of stalwarts in the Guild. And in the early 1960s, he led the movement to have the Guild pare its activities down to the one thing that seemed to be the really dominant demand of the age, and that was, how do we support the civil rights movement, particularly in the South, where it's especially beleaguered and where the many thousands being arrested for their activity on behalf of civil rights simply cannot find legal representation. The lawyers in the South simply would not represent civil rights activists. And so he takes the Guild into the South, first in Virginia and then in Mississippi in 1964, along with George Crockett. George Crockett is his partner, and in fact, one important aspect of this is that Ernie's one of the first to found integrated law firm in the United States, along with his longtime legal partner, George Crockett, who was later a U.S. congressman. And it's their effort in the South that supports the struggle for the freedom struggle in Mississippi and elsewhere. And it's what revives the Guild. It's what brought it back to and made it relevant to a whole new generation of activists and legal workers and lawyers who saw the Guild as a real alternative to the continuing conservative and segregationist practice of the ABA in that era.
Well, that's when I came around in 1965. Steve Babson, one of the three authors and principal author of The Color of Law, the story of Ernie Goodman. We all think that you had Clarence Darrow starting off the century and Bill Kunstler finishing it, and you had Ernie Goodman in the middle as really one of the great figures in the progressive bar and the social movement in America. And Steve Babson, you've done a marvelous job in capturing that social history. We thank you for your work, and we thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Steve. Here. It's really a wonderful book, and this interview was just terrific. It's great to talk to somebody so knowledgeable. Amazing.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well, of an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping here was broken, but my dream, it lingered near, in the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized, and my senses newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek the grace is shower. It's decreed that people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power.
Big banks have resumed the foreclosure process in 23 judicial states after a temporary suspension. Judicial states require a judge and court hearing for foreclosure proceedings, not so for the remaining 27 non-judicial states. Faulty databases that track mortgage foreclosures electronically have made big mistakes amid the high volume of mortgage defaults. Meanwhile, Bank of America started to file new paperwork for 102,000 foreclosures. Consumer advocates and lawyers for homeowners doubt Bank of America completed an accurate review of the paperwork. Attorney Ira Reingold, executive director of the National Association of Consumer Advocates, expressed his skepticism to one media source, saying, "These are lawyers. These are banks going to court and committing fraud," he said. "For them to say this is a minor technical problem is mind-boggling." This is part two of the mortgage crisis. The same banks the public bailed out stand to make hundreds of billions of dollars, more or less, on these new foreclosure of homes. Ira joins us today to talk further about the legality of the fast-track foreclosures. Attorney Ira Reingold, what's going on with the mortgage situation now?
Well, where do we begin? I mean, we have a broken mortgage system, and I think what you're seeing that sort of disclosed over the last couple of weeks, attorneys who represent homeowners in the foreclosure system have known for years that the same mortgage system that created all of those terrible mortgages, that mass-produced mortgages that led people into default and losing their homes, also created a mortgage servicing system that's completely broken, that's based on speed and reducing costs, and does almost nothing to attempt to allow people to save their homes. And I think what's been demonstrated by these sort of fraudulent affidavits is that everything that they were doing was to move people into foreclosure quickly, and anything that would stop them from moving quickly or cheaply, they avoided. They figured, oh, they're not going to get caught. They mass-produced these foreclosures, and they were just going to move ahead until some good attorneys in Maine and around the country got in front of a court all of the fraud that they had, in fact, had been committing when they were attempting to foreclose against people's homes.
Ira, give us an idea of what sort of fraud it is and what banks are involved in this massive fraud.
Well, I mean, the truth is it's all of them. The first announcement came out of GMAC, which is now Ally. But Bank of America has announced a moratorium, which they've apparently lifted. You have Wells Fargo, who has not done a self-imposed moratorium, but is equally culpable as anybody else. You have J.P. Morgan Chase. You have Citigroup. I mean, basically, it is the broader, it is the largest banks in the country who are involved in these servicing problems.
You're talking about my bank, Chase. What did Chase do here?
They're not one of the great actors of our time. And all of these entities who are involved in foreclosing on homes really have taken many shortcuts. And as a lawyer, I'm particularly offended by the law firms who are involved, who really are knowingly committing fraud on the court.
Well, you know, I know a lawyer here in New York City who was suspended from practicing law for allowing his secretary to sign a name after he notarized something.
Well, then, if that's the case, then the New York bars better start getting busy, because any of these foreclosure law firms who are involved in sort of mass-producing foreclosure cases, what we call foreclosure mill firms, are doing that kind of thing on a daily basis.
Now, Ira, I know that some of the banks are resuming their foreclosures, and how do we know they've changed their practices?
I'm fairly safe to say that they haven't changed their practices. The problems inside the mortgage servicing system is so systematic that the fact that they did a review and a week later said, "Oh, everything's okay, we're going to correct the few technical mistakes we made, we're going to move forward," is pretty much absurd. I mean, I think you need to recognize that the latest sort of newspaper articles, and I think they're beginning to expand on the problems, but initially involved these affidavits that servicers were putting in the court. And basically what they were saying on these affidavits is the person signing them said, "I have knowledge that we are the proper owner of the mortgage. I have knowledge that this is the amount that's owed. I have knowledge about all of these facts that would otherwise need to be pled in a court of law before you could win your case." Well, that person who was signing that affidavit was signing 500 that same day. No actual knowledge of anything, but simply was mass producing it. So that was sort of the first step. They don't have the documents before them. They rely on an electronic platform. So that person who's signing all these who is mass producing these affidavits, they're not suddenly going to get the documents. They're not suddenly going to have numerous staff going ahead and tracking down the documents and finding that, in fact, they have proper ownership, that the mortgage and the note was transferred properly to them. That's number one. Number two is that person is signing an affidavit that's simply saying, "This is the amount that's owed. I know it's the amount that's owed, and I've read a screen, and it says it's okay." There are fundamental problems in the servicing industry with their accounting practices. We have seen time and time again that industry, those banks, adding fees that they're not allowed to charge, misordering payments in ways, sort of like what we've seen in the credit card industry. So all of those fundamental problems, the fact that they don't have documentation about transfers, the fact that they really have done a very poor job in terms of keeping accounting records, are not going to be changed because they magically make an announcement and say, oh, we've investigated, everything's fine. We'll have a new person signing that affidavit, and they'll spend 10 minutes on it instead of the 30 seconds that they spent before.
Now, I understand that in all of the states, the attorneys general have launched probes into foreclosure practices, but that's going to take a while.
It may take a while. I mean, I think sort of the question is what you need to look at here is what do we want from that probe? I mean, I think the Justice Department is looking at them. I think FHA in particular, HUD, the servicers who service FHA loans, which are government loans, are government-backed loans, basically government-insured loans, are investigating and need to investigate because they're making claims on government insurance after they foreclose on people. What does it all mean, really? It's sort of the bottom line there is what does this demonstrate? One, it demonstrates that the banks can't be trusted. They couldn't be trusted making the loans. They can't be trusted servicing the loans. We've learned that. And if we haven't learned that, then we really haven't been paying any attention. What do we want for American homeowners and communities? Because the fact is that what the foreclosure crisis has done has devastated communities across this country, particularly low-income and minority communities. It just absolutely devastated places from you know, Detroit to Milwaukee to Chicago to Philadelphia to Baltimore to New York. So what do we want? The probe by the Attorney General, the probe by the Justice Department, what are we going to get the services to do? One is comply with the law. It really shouldn't be hard to say the states have foreclosure laws, you need to comply. You can't commit fraud on the courts, and you need to comply. That's number one. Once they do that, the cost of foreclosing against homeowners will increase substantially because right now what they're doing is what they minimally have to do, and they've avoided complying with the law because it costs them too much money. So once we raise the cost of them actually foreclosing against homeowners, one would hope they would take the next logical step and avoid foreclosures and instead spend the resources necessary, actually train staff, and build systems that actually allow people to get loan modifications, to allow people who can really afford to stay in their homes to stay in their homes. That's the way we rebuild our economy, not by speeding through foreclosures so that at the end of the day, you know, oh, they raced through the foreclosures and are now all out there in the open market. The way we rebuild our economy is allowing homeowners who are actually capable of affording a house at a reasonable price based on its actual value, stay in those homes. And the servicing industry has failed to do that, and the banks have failed to do that. And hopefully the investigation and potential litigation will sort of make them move in that direction and actually help people save their homes.
Attorney Ira Reingold, how many homes are we talking about here? I read somewhere that it's going to be some 3 million more foreclosures in the near future.
I think 2.5 million people have already been foreclosed. There's plenty there in the pipeline. I think we're talking at least 3 million foreclosures across this country.
Yeah, that's extraordinary.
And the fact is, I mean, so one of the things about this scandal, the fraud that's been committed here, is that they're pushing people through the foreclosure process, and many of those people, if they had been treated properly, if they would have complied with the law, if they would have followed the loan modification protocols that have been set out by states and by the federal government, they could have saved their home. And I think that's the most disappointing part of this process. I mean, beside the fact that they're committing fraud on the courts and they really bring into question sort of the notion of judicial due process for people, the fact is that people should not be in that situation. And if servicers had done their job properly, they never would be there because they would be sitting in their home paying a mortgage payment that they actually could afford.
You know, we've been looking at what Obama's position has been on this.
Right.
And there was at least a partial moratorium just because the banks were finally caught with their hand in a place it shouldn't be and with doing all of the stuff that went beyond the law and illegally. And then there were requests, and there have been repeated requests for a national moratorium on mortgages. And Obama continually says, we're not going to do it. It would hurt the economy too much. 25% of our housing stock is now in mortgages. It would wipe out people buying houses, wipe out realtors, et cetera. And I'd like to know what you think about Obama's position here and what the federal government ought to do at least right now.
Well, I think the Obama administration's position at this point has been incredibly disappointing. I think actually over the last couple of years, their response to the foreclosure crisis has been very disappointing. currently. So there's a couple things they should be doing right now. There are certain products, certain projects they can simply stop. So, instance, if it's an FHA loan.
The FHA, explain to our listeners what that is, an FHA.
An FHA mortgage is a mortgage that the federal government basically insures. It says, lender, make this loan in this community if you meet our guidelines, and if it winds up into default, you will get paid back in whole by the FHA insurance fund that we've created. FHA developed over the years because low-income and minority communities were not served by national banks. And so they created this insurance to convince lenders to go in there and make mortgages in those type of communities. In the last couple of years, because the whole sort of private lending marketplace has collapsed, because no one wanted to lend money, because the investors weren't buying the securities that these bonds were created, the FHA mortgage product is now probably about half of all mortgages that are made today. So the government has a bunch of rules and regulations in terms of how servicers are supposed to act, banks are supposed to act, when they foreclose on a home or when somebody winds up in default. There's no reason why the government can't say, for FHA mortgages, you can't foreclose. We need to be satisfied that you're, in fact, following the law and following the guidelines that we created. That's number one.
And that's half the mortgages in the United States, as you
say. Well, I mean, half the number of new mortgages in the United States. We're not talking about all the mortgages that have been made over the past years that are in trouble as well. But half of all new mortgages are now FHA mortgages. I'm not sure what percentage that is over the overall population. The number two is they've got this HAM program that everyone that there's been a lot of publicity about that theoretically is the government contracted with services with banks to agree to modify people's mortgages. Well, at this point, I view that HAM program as fairly dismal in its performance. I think they need to stop foreclosures and anybody who is contracted to comply with HAM, anybody who's a HAM signatory, which is pretty much all the major banks, and say you cannot move forward in your foreclosures until you modify mortgages in a real way and make them prove to the government that, in fact, they're complying with the law. And I also think they need to improve HAMP in many different ways. That's another very lengthy conversation.
What's that word you used?
HAMP?
It's Home Affordable Mortgage Program. It's basically the program. It was the Obama administration, the Treasury Department's attempt to help homeowners get their mortgages modified to keep in their homes. And unfortunately, it was dependent upon banks' goodwill and willingness to do a good job. And unfortunately, because of bank incompetence and in many ways bank venality, that program has not worked in any measurable successful way.
Ira is executive director of the National Association of Consumer Advocates. Do you work with a range of advocacy organizations?
Yeah, we do. I mean, so we're an association of attorneys, mostly legal services and private attorneys. Many of our attorneys who are in courtrooms across this country attempting to save people homes in foreclosure.
Excellent.
And if people want to find out more about your work, is there a website? I mean, it sounds great.
Sure.
And I think everybody here, at least more or less, has been a legal aid attorney in their lives.
That was my life until I came here.
So what's the website and where people can get more?
The website is NACA.net. The other website they can look at, so we run a project with the Center for Responsible Lending also called the Institute for Foreclosure Legal Assistance, and that's foreclosurelegalassistance.org. And there you'll see a number of legal services programs who specialize in representing homeowners who are faced with foreclosure.
It does seem to me, you know, when we talk about Obama and the failure so far to have any kind of a real moratorium, that people who are involved in buying houses right now, I mean, it seems that you'd be nuts to buy a foreclosed house because you don't know what the paperwork is like behind it and whether at some point they're going to come around and try and take your house back. So it does seem that a moratorium and an examination of all these papers is absolutely necessary.
I think you need to clean this place out, to clean the whole mess up. I think you need to spend time and make sure that they got it right and correct the errors. I mean, I think there are programs that the government needs to create to help people, help communities. When foreclosed homes are in a community, that devastates a home. Housing values decrease enormously. You know, blocks that have a number of foreclosed homes become very, you know, quickly deteriorate. So we need to figure out, I mean, I think the solution that you need to come up with are sort of multi-stage solutions. One is people who are in the foreclosure process, what are we going to do to help them to save their homes? Two, people who are outside the foreclosure process who have already lost their homes, what are we going to do in terms of affordable housing for them? And three, what are we going to do with the housing stock that's out there already that's been foreclosed? We haven't figured out that property is known as REO, which is property that's basically vacant that the mortgage lender owns. What are we going to do with that? I think as long as there's a cloud over foreclosed property, it will be tough, unless the title insurance industry is willing to do that, which apparently today they announced they would be willing to write title insurance on mortgages that have gone through foreclosure. For folks who have already bought homes in through the foreclosure process, I mean, who've bought homes that were foreclosed, probably have nothing to fear, because under the law they would most likely be bona fide purchasers, and as a bona fide purchaser, they would not have any danger of losing their homes. The mortgage company who sold them might have some problems. I think at this point it may be hard for them to be a bona fide purchaser when there's so much noise about the fact that title that's being sold to them may be problematic.
Ira, this has been really interesting.
The best website for people to go to?
It would be NACA.net.
Thank you very much,
thanks.
Ira.
Thanks a million,
thanks.
Ira.
Anytime, guys.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now you should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law and Disorder to your friends through Facebook.